the idea of chaos in the garden. Has everybody been here for the whole thing? Is there anybody who's new? I don't think so. So I don't have to really go back just to...
I don't think he's been here.
I've come to the first two.
Right? Sure.
Oh, maybe.
Sure.
We were here the first time. We only were here yesterday.
The idea that that God created the world good and created it as a garden, and actually created the first two humans as co-equals, and then with the chaos entering the garden in the disobedience of the two first humans, they are suddenly cast into a much more difficult world by their own choosing, a world where the woman is subservient to the man. At least in that story, a world where the man has to work very hard, a world where there's pain in childbirth, and a world where there's death. The man is going back to dust, man and the woman. But God clothes them because of God's deep and abiding love for them. He doesn't. God is not out to hurt them. God is really out to love them. But when they choose certain things, God has no choice but to let them reap the harvest of their choosing. God, in some ways, God simply can't save us when we choose against God, without somehow doing worse damage than we've already done. And then the last one that we did, we talked about the vineyard as a sort of symbol of God's attempt to recreate humanity, to give Israel a new chance. He brings Israel into a promised land, which he calls the vineyard, and plants it with good vines and a vat and a watchtower, and is looking for grapes, and he gets wild grapes. And then he says, well, what should I do about this, men of Jerusalem? What do you think I should do about it? And he says, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to tear it down. I mean, they didn't listen. Why am I going to tear it down? Because I looked for justice, and behold, bloodshed. I looked for righteousness, and behold, a cry. So there's a sense that there's a deep chaos in the garden, so deep that there's nothing really to be salvaged anymore. But on the other hand, we've read the idea of the vine and the branches, that Jesus says to the disciples on the night before he's killed, he says to them, I am the vine, you are the branches. In the vineyard that God is now creating, I am the one that is rooted, you are the ones that are bearing the fruit, abide in me. If you don't abide in me, if you don't bear fruit, you'll be cut forth, burned, and all of that. But if you abide in me, you will be pruned, bear much fruit, you will show the world the love that God has for the world. So there's God taking a proactive stance and inserting Jesus into this vineyard as a sort of last-ditch effort to resurrect the garden that can really bear fruit. So we come to today, but first let's say a prayer. Lord God, we give you thanks for the garden that you have given to us, the garden of our lives, the garden of this wilderness called Holden, the garden of our relationships with our families, with our lovers, with our friends, for the garden of our relationships here at Holden. Help us to be rooted in you, O Christ. Grant that we may see all that we do this day as a bearing of the fruit that your life has given us the possibility of bearing. And help us to be people who give thanks for all of the challenges and all of the difficulties of bearing this fruit, that we may always be poised on gratitude and on joy, and finding new ways to worship and love you through all that we do. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So the garden that I want to go to today is the garden of that night, actually. The garden of the night that Jesus has talked about the vine and the branches. Later that night, he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane with his disciples. So let's turn to Mark chapter 14. Chapter 14 in Mark, verse 32 to 50. We have two sections there, so maybe two readers could read it. Mark 14, 32 to 50.
And they went to a place which was called Gethsemane. He said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took with him Peter, James, and John. He began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even in death. Remain here and watch." And going a little further, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, an hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible to thee. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what thou wilt." And he came and found them sleeping. He said to Peter, "Simon, why are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray, that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. And he came a third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It's enough. The hour is come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand."
And immediately while he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I shall kiss is the man. Seize him and lead him away under guard." And when he came, he went up to him at once and said, "Master," and he kissed him. And they laid hands on him and seized him. But one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus said to them, "Have you come out against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled." And they all forsook him and fled.
If you want to.
And the young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body. And they seized him. But he left the linen cloth and ran away naked.
And they were naked and were not ashamed. I never thought of that.
Don't they think that this was Mark? Because he was the only one that knew.
So once again we're in a garden, once again we're naked. Is this a rare thing or a new thing that Jesus goes, drags his disciples out to a garden someplace? He does it frequently, right? Especially when you think of Peter, James, and John. What do you think of when you think of those three going with Jesus to a garden place? When did
Transfiguration.
Transfiguration, right?
They went up the mountain.
Yeah, they went up the mountain, and that too could be seen as a kind of a garden, because it's really a place that is where Jesus is. Absolutely seen in an absolutely new light by them. All kinds of strange things happen. That's where Peter wants to build those booths, remember? And stay there for a long time, as if somehow it's a new creation has already happened, so let's stay up here.
He's covetous.
Covetous?
He is covetous at that time.
Yeah. he wants to have it.
Right.
Yeah. So he takes these three, and first he tells all the disciples to sit down, and then he takes these three and goes a little bit further and tells them some hard news. He says, my soul is very mournful, sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch. And then Jesus goes and falls on his face in the middle of the garden and prays to God. What is this passage? How does this passage make you feel about Jesus? What kind of insight does it give you into Jesus that you didn't have before? I don't mean didn't have before in your life, but didn't have before in the gospel as you're reading along.
This is not something you really wanted to do.
Right, and in a certain sense, you didn't know that before, right?
Yeah, you know, because everything he was saying leading up to the cross was kind of, you know, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, and all of a sudden, it was coming to the point where he knew it was about to happen, and he was going, I think I'm getting cold feet.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe in that sense, I think it gave you more of a the side of his humanity. I mean, God part of him said before, this is the way I'm supposed to be fulfilled, I'm supposed to suffer and die on the cross, but then the human part said, no, I don't know if I want to really do this. This is going to be painful.
Plus he's feeling pain for himself, where most of the time he's thinking of someone else, mm-hmm. healing others.
Yeah,
he's like,
human side of Jesus.
And that warning to Peter was, it was just, he knew what Peter was going to go through, and he knew what he should be doing to counteract that. And, mm-hmm. When Peter denied him three times, he was saying, "Don't, you're going to fall into temptation." Mm-hmm. And I think he was somewhat getting himself ready, or getting himself mentally prepared for this whole situation that was about to.
Oh, the betrayal business.
Yeah. Because I don't think he would, mentally, I think he was probably kind of down and saying, I really don't, not only do I not want to go through this, it's just, I got to prepare myself to do this because, being I really don't want to do it.
Possibly. My sense is that what Anne said might be more true, that he really is, how did you say it, really vulnerable? Oh yeah, he was taking care of everybody else all the time, and in saying these sort of prophetic things and teaching, and all of a sudden it's coming down to his own destiny, and I think that may be a whole new thing for Jesus to face that, and we really do see his humanity, as Gil was pointing out. What does he say here that we wouldn't say?
Yeah,
right. Or that it would be harder for us to say. I don't know. Do you think you'd be able to say the stuff he says? Well, I'd be able to say that fine. I'd be able to say that. This is really a pain, God. I really don't want to do this.
But that it be your will, God.
Right. Okay. What prayer does that remind you of? Lord's Prayer, right? Here Jesus is actually praying the Lord's Prayer, the prayer that he told us to pray, but he's praying it in a context that's excruciatingly painful for him and is going to have a very grave effect on him as a person. Thy will be done.
Now, I wonder if he's beginning to understand his sense of true sense of who he is. He always called himself the Son of Man, God, and his destiny to fulfill. He certainly must have known politically what was happening, the ramifications of his behavior, where it would get him, in light of the Romans and the Pharisaical law of the day, but and their attitudes towards him. But his element. his human elements are beginning to come out strong. For instance,
yeah.
In the garden, when he didn't want to be alone, he wanted the company
mm-hmm.
of those who he was with, asked them not to go to sleep, to watch with him and pray.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
That he really needs them to be there.
Yes.
He's not just sort of like going out to do a little performance or, you know, spend some time until Judas arrives. But he's really feeling pressed. He's really feeling stressed.
So the conflict within himself at that point, his divine self and his human self.
Now if you think about, I just thought of something that's interesting. If you think about Jesus in the middle of this garden by himself, and you think about Eve in the middle of the garden by herself, what's the difference between their responses?
Thy will, God's will being done. Yeah. Where it was her will.
Exactly. Isn't that interesting? How for Eve, it's Eve can't say thy will be done, or she doesn't know yet how to say thy will be done. What Eve ends up saying is, the fruit, how does it go? The fruit was good to eat, delightful to the eyes, and much to be desired to make one wise. So she just like gets off on this human trip. Now if Jesus would do that, what would happen? He would say it would be good for him to be alive for a few more years. It was it would be delightful not to have to die tomorrow. Plus it would be greatly to be desired to have a wife and a family and a house and, you know, or something like that. And so he, you know, took off out the back gate of the garden and was never seen again.
Yeah, I heard that our, I think it was the Good Friday sermon that our pastor had this last Easter season. Anyway, I think he said something to the effect of, well, Jesus could have, like you say, escaped out the back of the garden and retired into private life.
Right.
So that was kind of interesting.
Built.
Yeah, he could have.
Could have started a Habitat for Humanity up in Rome someplace, right?
Right.
I think it's interesting that he says to Peter, he says, watch and pray that you may not fall into temptation. And I've always had the sense that Jesus was saying that as much to himself as he was to Peter.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that before as this garden scene being a second temptation, or being, you know, Eve's temptation, she fails. Here's Jesus' temptation, and he doesn't fail.
But isn't it kind of, if he doesn't follow through, Satan's won. Evil's won.
That's right. That's right. Here, and people say about this, theologians talking about the what actually goes on in the passion of Jesus, frequently say, and I agree with them, that that the battle is won or lost here in Gethsemane. That from Gethsemane on, Jesus is like the lamb who before its shearers is dumb, opens not its mouth. Jesus really doesn't say much to Pilate. He doesn't say much on the cross. A few words, a few cries, howls, you know, from the cross. It really is. I mean, it's just, it's these incomprehensible struggles of Jesus, though, you know, some kind words also to the thief. But here he sort of sets his face and finally makes the final decision. No, I am not going to run away from this. If you can spare me, God, do that, but your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. What about the disciples? I mean, do they have any idea of what's going on here?
I have a question. Is it just a coincidence that he comes back and finds him asleep three times, and is it Peter?
Who denies him three times?
Denying him three times?
it's hard to figure out what that what the connection would be. Three times is a definite, you know, indictment. I mean, somebody, you don't need to have four times. I mean, two times might just be a coincidence. Three times is, you know.
It's blasphemy.
Yeah. But it is this sad, poignant thing that Jesus is out there making the decision of his career, of his life, a decision that leads to his death, and his closest friends are oblivious. I think it's another sign of how the disciples had no idea what was going on. And it's wonderful if you think about the disciple who told this story so that it could be written down. It was Peter, James, and John who told this story. They're the ones who owned up to it. This is a pretty awful thing. I mean, if this happened today, that somebody was really suffering out in the woods and somebody went out there, tried to help him, and really did a bad job of it, and it later turned out that person was God or something like that and was raised from the dead or something like that, and then disappeared, I wonder if we'd be willing to own up to how badly we botched it, you know, personally, how much of a fool how much of a fool I was or something. I mean, I tend to feel like it's more fun to tell the truth than to cover up, but I think most people might not agree with me. But it's a kind of a testimony to Peter, James, and John's sense that they really were loved by God, that they could actually tell how screwball they were in the last days, and yet Jesus loved them, even when he was raised from the dead. This is definitely, the Gospels are definitely not a very kind portrayal of the disciples, which helps you to believe that they are true, because it's the disciples who wrote them. So the disciples weren't sort of setting themselves up as nice guys. They really told the truth when they wrote these things down, told these stories.
Well, this is the, 3 o'clock in the morning or something, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Or after midnight. And the second time, he says, their eyes were very heavy. You know, who wouldn't be asleep under these conditions?
Well, he's saying that...
Except somebody who knew what was going on.
Yeah,
like Jesus.
But it was a very politically charged time. They had come into Jerusalem. People had gathered around Jesus. 10,000 people gathered around Jesus, said, "We want you to be king. We want you to be king." The disciples were sitting there saying, yeah, we're going to be in, you know, this new kingdom. This is going to work out. And then Jesus goes and throws the tables over in the temple, and the disciples are there, no, don't do this. So it's a very politically charged time. And if you were, like, the right-hand person of Mike Dukakis, and it seemed like maybe he'd be elected president, and things were going well, and all of a sudden it turned out that he was having an adulterous affair or something, and he was going into a church to pray, and he said to you, his right-hand person, listen, keep your eyes open here at the front door. Anything happens, let me know. Watch and pray that you don't enter into temptation. It's a good chance that you'd stay awake. You know, because the stakes were very, very high for the disciples at that point. It was a life and death kind of issue for them, and as well as for Jesus, and I think they pretty much knew that. So I think what David was saying is pretty true, that the fact that they fell asleep is a highly significant sign of their own inability to resist temptation, or intentional about this time. The chaos, in a sense, has enveloped them. The chaos has not enveloped Jesus. With Eve, the chaos envelops Eve when the serpent comes, and she can't think straight anymore. It's just sort of what temptation is about. I mean, isn't it true that we fall short when we stop thinking straight?
You know, the act of Jesus in the temple when he upturned the table is significant, has always been significant to me, because we often equate anger with being involved in emotion. And he demonstrates very, very openly his emotion, mm-hmm. of anger in a violent way. And you talk about, or made mention of the fact of people not thinking straight. There was a rebellion. If this happened today, would say, he's not acting rationally. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are places. There are places when his mothers and brothers show up in the Gospel of Mark where they say, send him out here, this guy's nuts. Let us take him home. And Jesus says, who are my mothers and my brothers? It's anyone who does the will of the Father. They are my mother, my brothers, and my sisters. So Jesus, yeah, he was taken for crazy. The emotion that I'm interested in here, though, is his sorrow, his ability to sorrow about his own life, as Anne was saying. And he really enters into his own personal death in a way that is profound, really profound. So there's chaos in the garden. The disciples are sort of overwhelmed by it. Jesus manages to get through, but more chaos shows up on the front door when Judas and the others come. What do you think about Judas betraying him with a kiss? Is that just a sort of random detail?
That was a sign for the soldiers to take him.
Mm-hmm. Why did Judas settle on that? Maybe. I hadn't thought of that. That's a possibility. That he comes up, kisses him, and says, hi, hail master. And then all of a sudden these soldiers jump out of the bushes and grab Jesus, and then Judas is sort of... It's hard to imagine that people wouldn't, you know, associate the two.
I think it's kind of... he knew what he was going to do, but in a way, there was part of him that didn't want to do it because he loved Jesus. And so it was like a last attempt to kind of maybe show him that he still wanted to be close to him, but there was this other thing that was pulling him.
Hmm. Well, there was always something pulling Judas from the start, because he was ripping off the treasury that they had. He was his motives, being a zealot, his motives were totally different. He was looking at Jesus to take the to just kind of overwhelm Rome and say, we are a powerful nation, and I am the leader of this powerful nation. And all of a sudden, hey, it wasn't happening.
But in this, that's the Gospel of John needs to make Judas, or whoever's writing the Gospel of John, let's say John, when John writes it, he really makes Judas into a slimy character, sort of snake. But that isn't necessarily true in Mark. Judas doesn't come out with as nearly as bad a rep in Mark, but I like what you said there, that somehow he's torn by this as well, that Judas is struggling very deeply with this. It's curious that he decides to betray him, though. You know, I mean, if he's struggling with it deeply, at least if I were struggling with it deeply, I would just sort of sit tight for a while. It's hard to imagine that Judas really wanted the money.
He'd sort of gone too far for that, though, hadn't he? Because he'd already made the bargain with the elders.
Yeah.
And he'd already been sort of, how shall we say, blessed and sent upon his way, on his mission, to betray this crazy man.
By the priests, you mean?
Yes.
The priests, yeah.
Because he went to them first.
Yeah. It's a sad story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you start to think about it, maybe in a moment of anger, or in a moment of, as you were saying, sort of political, some political manipulative, you know, I want to get this guy out of the way so I can lead a movement to rebel. He decides to do that, but then he decides to betray him, but then having these second thoughts. I mean, you could really write a story about Judas that would be... Have they?
Yeah.
It's true. Maybe people.
But it seems like, you know, this is really a sign of hate to do that sort of thing. And to me, I think of this love-hate relationship. You can only hate a person really badly if you also love that person very much.
I have to read it. This looks good. Judas. Nobody can be sure, of course, why Judas sold Jesus out. although according to John's gospel, he already had a reputation for dipping into the poor box from time to time, so the cash may have been part of it. If, like the other disciples, he was perennially worried about where he stood in the pecking order, he may also have been reacting to some imagined slight. Maybe he thought his job as treasurer to the outfit was beneath him. Another possibility is that he had gotten fed up with waiting for Jesus to take the world by storm and hoped that betraying him might force him to show his hand at last. That's a nice idea. Or maybe because nothing human is ever uncomplicated, something of all of these was involved. Anyway, whatever his reasons were, the whole thing went sour for him soon enough. Slipping out of the Last Supper before the party was over, he led the way to the garden that he knew they were planning to adjourn to afterwards and said to lay low till he gave the signal. It was dark by the time his former associates showed up, and maybe for fear that he might scare them off if he used any other method, the way he showed the soldiers which was the one to jump was by kissing him. That was all he'd been paid to do, and as soon as he'd done it, there was no earthly reason why he couldn't have taken off with his laundered cash and found a place to spend it. But when the time came, he wasn't in the mood. There are several versions of what he did instead, of which the most psychologically plausible seems to be that he gave the money back to given it to him and went out and hanged himself. This time, there didn't seem to be any ambiguity about the motive. There's a tradition in the early church, however, that his suicide was based not on despair but on hope. If God was just, then he knew that there was no question where he would be heading as soon as he breathed his last. Furthermore, if God was also merciful, he knew there was no question either that in a last-ditch effort to save the souls of the damned as God's son, Jesus would be down there too. The way Judas figured it, hell might be the last chance he'd have of making it to heaven. So to get there as soon as possible, he tied the rope around his neck and kicked away the stool. Who knows? In any case, it's a scene to conjure with. Once again, they met in the shadow, the two old friends, both of them a little worse for wear after all that had happened. Only this time it was Jesus who was the one to give the kiss. And this time it wasn't the kiss of death that was given. I put that guy can write.
I'm going to get all that out of a few passages.
I see Judas as an extremely manipulative person. And I think that he always thought was doing the right thing. I really believe that he always thought that he was doing the right thing. But because, well, you know, it's like so much for manipulative behavior, you know, it usually ends up in soup anyway.
Well, I mean, if he was manipulative from the start, it's hard to imagine that he commits suicide. It's really hard to imagine.
Not for me, because once you find that your action has really gone so far that you cannot recall it, and there's still love there. There's still hope.
Oh, well. But then I don't think he was always manipulative. I think then he was somewhat taken with Jesus, that he had his heart open a little bit to what Jesus was.
But he was always pushing things. He was always trying to make things happen and control situations all the time.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. He's the bad guy.
And that's what I'm talking about, with manipulative behavior.
People think they are right no matter what.
Exactly. Yeah. And they really believe in that they are doing the right thing,
but they're not stricken with conscience.
I mean, you can't. The problem with the portrayal of Judas is that you can't have him be totally bad and still commit suicide.
Yeah.
Because if he were totally.
Well, manipulative behavior is not totally bad. I mean, it's something that that every one of us gets caught in at one time or another, and it's just. It's one way that we have of getting our own way, and usually it doesn't work.
Yeah.
That's really all it is. Yeah.
Why was Judas needed in the first place? Jesus wasn't this man that said he was the Son of God. No, he was not an unknown individual. Palm Sunday gone by, and why did quote somebody? I suppose somebody was it, a Roman, some soldier. Why did he have to know for sure who Jesus was through this kiss from Judas?
I think it's more that Judas had to lead. I think that Jesus was underground, as they say, you know. And I don't think that the Jews or the Romans at that point had a secret police that really patrolled the place and would be able to find out where Jesus was exactly. So Jesus was so it was important to find someone who would be able to give Jesus over to the authorities at a time when the authorities when there wouldn't be a riot. So it had to be at night. It had to be when Jesus was alone. And so it turns out that the chief priests and people were trying to figure a way out, and Judas found out about that. And so Judas said, "Here I am. Give me some money, and I'll do it." It's just the way it happened, Gil. It wasn't like at the beginning of creation.
Who needed him? He rode on his donkey into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, and goodness sakes alive, there must have been a lot of people that saw that. At least that's what one of the books says.
Sure.
And here he's got to be, Jesus has to be kissed.
You have to remember, though, that this is
Jesus to be sure they got the right fella.
This is sort of like New Orleans during Mardi Gras. I mean, it'd be like trying to find Gladsome Gil in New Orleans during Mardi Gras. You know, you couldn't just like call up the operator and say, "There's some guy in town named Gladsome Gil, and he came in, you know,
riding a donkey
a couple days ago, and we want to torture and kill him. So just give us his phone number, you know."
I'm sorry I took up the minute.
I don't see Judas as a
bad guy. Well, I wanted the same thing, though.
You did?
Yes.
Hooray!
Hosanna.
And I don't see Judas as a bad guy.
Well, yeah. That's a whole other story. Well, the point is not, I sort of did a side trip on Judas, but this chaos comes into the garden. Jesus is the one who, unlike Eve, says, "Thy will be done," but nevertheless, there is chaos enveloping him, symbolized not only by the false kiss, not only by the disciples falling asleep, but also by a detail we haven't talked about yet, is the violence, someone drawing the sword and cutting off somebody's ear. And Jesus says, Jesus puts an end to that and goes into his "Thy will be done" routine, and everybody flees, including this unknown person whose tunic is grabbed, and he goes away naked as the day he's born, which is, I hadn't thought about before, but it'd be a great way to pick up on the two gardens, the garden of creation with the nakedness not ashamed and the nakedness ashamed, and then the garden of Gethsemane, or garden of Jesus' struggle, where people run away naked and utterly ashamed and utterly, with this sense of utter doom. The chaos has taken over the world, that the Son of God, the one who claimed to be the Son of God, is about to die, that betrayal is the order of the day, violence, and the disciples have yet to betray him, and at least Peter has yet to betray him verbally. But it's pretty bleak time. Chaos has taken over. But Jesus has said, "Thy will be done," which is an interesting difference. Let's just, before we quit, turn to John chapter 20 and look at another garden that follows closely on the heels of this one. It's the garden in which, to which Mary Magdalene goes out on the first day of the week. She, because it was the Sabbath the day before, she couldn't go out. You can't get close to dead people on the Jewish Sabbath. You become unclean. It's a very unholy thing to do. But as soon as she wakes up or can't sleep that night, she walks out to that garden. And it's still dark, but she notices that the stone has been rolled away. You know that it was probably full moon because of the the way they celebrated Passover, so it was full moon. She could see in the light of the full moon, 4 a.m., that the stone was rolled away. She runs and wakes up the disciples. They come running up, Peter and John. John beats Peter to the tomb but doesn't go in. Peter pokes in, sees what's going on. John looks in, describes the scene that they see, napkins here and there, folded. I mean, it's almost as if there was order in the tomb instead of chaos. The beloved disciple, John, believes at that point. Peter doesn't say anything about what Peter makes of it, but they disappear. Mary remains. And why don't we read from verse 11 to verse 18. Someone read that?
But Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." At this she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet returned to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, "I have seen the Lord," and she told them that he had said these things.
Thanks. So this is a garden a few days later. Why is it that Mary, what is it in Mary's personality that makes it possible for her to have this revelation? How's she different from Peter and John?
She listened.
Listen. To whom?
She listened to Jesus, and she had a very good idea. I mean, she probably had a closer relationship to Jesus than most of the disciples. Because
in what sense?
Well, when she was forgiven, when she laid ointment oils on him, it seemed to me that she was probably listening about every word he said, and probably knew his mannerisms, his characteristics, his attitude.
So she kind of hunched out that he was going to be there?
I don't know if she hunched out that he was going to be there that night. I think there was something that drew her there.
So what was it that drew her there?
Probably her love for him.
Uh-huh. How was it expressed?
That night? Well, she wanted to cling to him.
Not before that. She was just like absolutely destroyed by this whole thing.
The word stood weeping. She was expressing her feelings. She was just doing what she was feeling.
Exactly. And that's, it's a very interesting thing that in her ability to remain with what she was feeling and not jump to any conclusions or do anything about it, and her just almost helplessness at that point keeps her around long enough so that Jesus can come to her. Jesus could have just as easily come to Peter and John. I mean, he must have been around.
So the disciples, when they went back to their homes, they didn't have the feeling that she did. I mean, they didn't have the deep emotions at that point.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I'm wondering if that's...
Then the disciples went back to their homes. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I mean, they're like...
Oh,
and then they go back.
Let's go.
Let's go back home.
Yeah.
Let's go home.
There was a song Don Francisco did where he talks about that. And his thought about Peter in that song was, as he was going towards the tomb and after he left it, everything that he'd seen just added to his shame. He didn't really know how he could face Jesus.
Well, that's interesting.
For what he had done.
So Peter was so bound up by his own guilt that he just didn't want to hang out.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Maybe too grief-stricken to come.
I don't think we can say that they didn't have feelings. I think that we can say that they, at that time, they were not willing to express them or go with those feelings. But we sure can't say that they didn't have feelings about it.
No.
Well,
but I think it's, go ahead.
If you're going to talk about the social situation at the time that Jesus was underground, wouldn't it be safe to assume that they would have to be underground?
Oh, they were, yeah, that's right.
And a woman was ignored. You know, I mean,
that's a possibility. That
I'm not saying that she, this is wonderful that a woman is the first witness and the first one to just be open to the idea that Christ has risen and isn't dead and didn't leave them for, you know, because wasn't there in somewhere that he had just left them? You know, you were going to be this great king and now you just left us?
He's dead.
And there was more anger maybe in, I don't know, it just seemed that maybe there was more anger in the disciples with the grief, mixed with the grief, and hers was just grief. That was my understanding. But when I don't think they felt real comfortable or safe just walking around the place and demanding to know where Jesus was.
Well, in a sense, they were caught up in the chaos in a different way. They were caught up in the chaos, and their response was to defend themselves, lay low, to try to protect themselves. Her response was that of being totally, I don't know, maybe I'm off on this, but it feels to me like she is, just absolutely forlorn, I mean, just wiped out. Jesus was the first, if you read Mary as the woman who anointed Jesus' feet and as the one whom Jesus forgave, you can image her as having for the first time experienced who she really is in the presence of Jesus. So she in a sense had lost a lot more than the disciples when Jesus died, because the disciples just lost this teacher that they had been going with for a few years. She lost the first person who ever opened to her what it meant to be loved, really loved, and so she is just devastated by that. It's in that devastation that she holds still long enough. You know, you could almost make a point that she's what she's doing here is she's praying. You know? She's just allowing herself to remain as a little child, waiting to see what's going to happen, or not even waiting to see what's going to happen, but just leaving herself, allowing herself to be totally open to what is happening around her.
It sort of turns around the old saying, instead of don't just do something, stand there.
Yeah, right.
but it was also, Jesus was the first person that gave total meaning to her life. All of a sudden, you know, here she was, a prostitute, and Jesus has totally forgiven her, and her whole lifestyle's changed, and all of a sudden she's seeing life in a totally different way than she ever had before, and to have that one person who really truly loved her for who she was taken away, might have been the whole.
Isn't it also interesting, I mean, if you think of Eve again, and you think of Mary, Mary, in fact, as Mary doesn't do anything. Mary just remains with the fear or the sadness or whatever, does nothing, where Eve did do something and it was kind of a mess. Mary doesn't allow the chaos to, she's not afraid of the chaos, she just stands in the middle of the chaos. You know, and it's then that God comes to Mary, standing in the midst of her own personal devastation. Jesus comes to her and calls her by name, and calls her forth out of the chaos. She still does. That's when she recognizes him, right? He says, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And then he says, Mary. And she her eyes are open. She says, teacher. And then she wants to throw her arms around him for joy. And he says, no. Isn't that disappointing? I mean, I always think that's a little disappointing. I want her to be able to hold him for a minute, and for him to say, it's good that you're here. Things are going to be different. You can't hold me in the future. I have to go back to God.
I think it says something a little bit about the grieving process, how it can be different for men and women in general. Women, this may be sexist, I don't know, but I think women as being more emotional and just and letting their grief come out more, and men are kind of like, well, okay, now we gotta kind of get back to business. And then, so like allowing yourself to feel the grief and just be in it at that moment, the Lord can kind of give you peace.
Yeah. Takes us back to the theme of the summer, the idea that something is afoot in the universe. Elmer did a nice sermon last Sunday. No, sometime earlier than that. Friday, maybe. Was it Friday? Do you remember what he said? Something about that finally, maybe what it means to be part of the new creation is to discover that there's a more feminine way of being for all of us, that would lead to the healing of the wounds of creation, and that Jesus really was in that sense one who brought a different way into the very patriarchal, very priest-centered, very law-centered Jewish religion, brought a very relational-centered, very personal-centered, very healing-centered, very nurturing kind of ministry. And that, that's where the kingdom is breaking through, is when we are able, each one of us, to discover that part in our lives which is not controlled and afraid, but which is vulnerable and nurturing. Certainly, what we see here is Jesus giving to her a ministry. He says, "I'm going away to my God and your God, to my Father and your Father. Go and tell the disciples that you have seen me." And you can imagine that Mary, instead of wanting to cling to Jesus and hold on to him, suddenly has this kind of shot of courage, realizing that Jesus will always be with her. It's not just a question of now in the garden, but that it may just be this insight that sort of changes everything for her. If you think about it, the garden, what happens here is that the garden is restored, that each one of us, in being baptized into Jesus, has this new creation, which Jesus has established, say, by being obedient to God, where Eve was disobedient. Jesus, sent by God, shows us God's love in a way that just has not been clear before in this new creation, this new garden. is given to each one of us in baptism as a gift. And we have that and so we live in these end times sort of as God begins to bring the final culmination and Jesus comes again. We are in the end times sort of trying to live as deeply as possible in this baptism.
This is kind of a comfort too when you think of, I remember when, especially in really difficult times, the death of, you know, when it said, God, why aren't you just here right now? I think we all feel that sometimes. Why aren't you just coming down to earth and stand here and let me hold you, or let me really know that you're here. You know, I want somebody with skin on. I don't just want you up here someplace. And I'm sure we all feel that. But here he said to Mary, you cannot touch me. I mean, you cannot hold me. So we have to then in faith and in trusting and knowing that he loves us, even though we cannot have that one-to-one. There's no way we can have it, and we all know that. But I think there are times
with Jesus, you mean?
With Jesus, but there are times in our lives when I'd like to have Jesus come right down here beside me, like I set the table, you know. But I'd like to have him really be there, and we can't. The closest we can come, we can't. He's told us we cannot hold him after this happened. I mean, he's a new dimension.
A new dimension. Yeah, he's transformed.
In the new dimension that has to be taken into our lives in a different way.
In contrast, before Peter knew Jesus had been taken from the grave, didn't he say, I'm going fishing?
Yes, we did.
It actually happens about 15 or 20 verses after this story. So but he does, for some reason or other, Peter wants to go fishing instead of go be an evangelist. And Jesus stops him short and says, Simon, do you love me? Peter says, yeah, I love you. He says, feed my sheep 3 times. And he says, when you were young, you went wherever you wanted to go and tied your own belt around you. When you're old, you're going to go where you don't want to go. And somebody else is going to tie you up. And then it says, this Jesus said to show what kind of a death that Peter was going to die. And then it says, and Jesus said to them, follow me. It's a wild story. I wish we had time to go into that one too.
But here, he really gives Mary Magdalene something to do. She wasn't just there.
Yeah, he gives her a job.
And she waited until she had one.
She wasn't too anxious, in other words.
Well, just this story, I mean, I'm not going to try to read too much into it, but she stood there and she waited in the presence of the Lord until she had something to do from the Lord.
Yeah, that's nice. Well, you have something to do from the Lord. You have a whole creation to go out there and celebrate. It's a great day. Tomorrow we're going to look at the tree of life. Going to get back to the tree of life.